Find the book of Hosea in the Old Testament. If you could find an old Hebrew Bible, Hosea is actually the first of what's called the Book of the 12 Prophets. Hosea was a prophet to Israel, the northern kingdom, after the northern and southern kingdoms had separated. So now that you know that history, there's Judah, and then there's Ephraim, Israel, the northern kingdom, and he was a prophet to the northern kingdom. He was a prophet before the Assyrian captivity. So Hosea predicted that the Assyrian captivity was going to happen. So you know that David had united the kingdoms both. David ruled over all of Israel, the unified kingdom, and then during the time of Solomon, his servant Jeroboam got the northern 10 tribes. The two southern tribes stayed with David. It was during the time that Jeroboam was king, during the time of the first real evil kings of Israel, and there was a whole series of evil kings from there, that ruled over the northern kingdom. And it was during the last of the evil kings that Hosea pops up. And he predicts that God is going to punish the northern kingdom by bringing the Assyrian captivity. So Hosea knows that captivity is coming. And what's important for you to realize and remember is that during the Assyrian captivity, the Assyrian king moved Assyrian people, foreigners, into the land of what once was the northern kingdom of Israel. The Canaan land, that area, was taken over then by Assyrians. And so after the Assyrian captivity, which really only affected the northern tribe, it didn't affect the southern tribes much at all. The southern tribes of Judah remained intact and continued to remain intact and had to remain intact and couldn't be scattered and dispersed because they had the promise that the Messiah was going to come through them. So God always retained the southern kingdom right up until the time of the Messiah. 70 years after Jesus' birth, roughly, 70 AD, finally he busted up the southern kingdom, destroyed the temple, and for the first time the southern kingdom was really completely dispersed up until 1948. But the northern kingdom never recovered after the Assyrian captivity. That's really important to know when you read this stuff in Hosea. So the northern 10 tribes, which went on to become the lost tribes, the lost sheep of the house of Israel, that's who we're talking about here. The southern kingdom, Judah, Benjamin, the Levites that served in the temple, remained intact during the Assyrian captivity. But the northern kingdoms were taken into captivity. Assyrians came and lived in their land. All sorts of different foreigners and slaves, everybody, were sent into that land to occupy it. So when the Assyrian captivity ended, after the Assyrians were conquered by the Babylonians and in came the Medo-Persians, when Cyrus finally let them all go, and said, okay, you can return to your homeland, there was no homeland for them to return to. And that's why the northern kingdoms became sort of marauding tribes, and then, of course, as you've often heard me say, kind of disappear historically as they move north through the Caucasus Mountains. And so, as you hear Hosea talking here about Ephraim and Israel, he's predicting that God is going to call them not my people. He's going to say, I've taken my mercy from you, and he's going to say, I'm going to disperse you, I'm going to scatter you, I'm going to give you over to your lovers. They have been sacrificing to and worshiping idols. And so God says, okay, you want idols? I'm going to give you over to your idols. And he sends them into Assyria, which is the heart of that heathen idol culture. So God goes completely overboard. It's just like when they said, we want meat to eat. And he said, okay, and gave them quail up to their knees. They wanted the Assyrian idols. And so God says, fine, you want your idols? I'll send you to the place where it's nothing but idols. And they go to live in Assyria. So more than any other book in the Old Testament, you see not only the prediction of God giving up the northern kingdom, scattering them, putting them under captivity, giving them over to their idols, but you also see, which I got to back up again, all that stuff that Hosea is going to predict is going to happen actually happened. Physically, genuinely, literally happened. They did go into the Assyrian captivity. They were scattered. They were sent off. They lost their culture. They're not God's people. All of the stuff he's going to predict actually happened. But then Hosea is also going to say that God is going to go to those exact same people, regather them, restore them, call them my beloved, call them my people, draw them back to himself, restore them in the same land he gave them in the first place, and all of that must equally happen. Hosea has been completely 100% right about the first half. So there's every reason to believe that he's going to be 100% right about the second half. But God hasn't done it yet. So meanwhile, in the book of Romans, Paul, in talking about election And has God given up his people whom he foreknew? Has God, in fact, given up Israel? Because that's the natural question we looked at the last couple weeks. Well, then, what about Israel? God foreknew Israel and loved and chose Israel, and now he's gone and scattered them, and they're gone, and they're everywhere, so then God must not keep his word. Paul's argument has been, yes, of course he keeps his word. To begin with, there's the remnant, there's me, Paul. I'm an Israelite, and he saved me, so he's clearly not utterly forsaken his people. He's kept a remnant of the people, and now he starts arguing about the balance of the people. And he's going to talk about the fact that the balance was blinded, and the balance was scattered, and that was on purpose, so that the time of the Gentiles would begin, and God could bring the Gentiles in, and the time of the church would happen. And then his conclusion is going to be that when the time of the Gentiles is finished, he's going to return back and do these things that he's promising here in Hosea, that he's going to return his people to their land, keep all his promises, make them his people, he will be their God. All of that has to come true. All that has to come true, or else God's lying. That seems so clear to me, it seems so obvious, and it's said over and over in the Old and in the New Testament. So first we're going to read the story from Hosea, and then you're going to see how Paul utilizes the Hosea story in his argument about Israel and about God keeping his word to his people. Got all that? So today is just about Hosea. We're going to read the story of Hosea, and then we're going to see how Paul applied it in the New Testament. And if Paul, in fact, applied the story of Hosea in the New Testament, then he's saying that promise is still good. That promise is still true. God is still dangling that promise out there in front of Israel. And it hasn't happened yet, so it's still a future thing. As you've heard me say over and over and over again, the church is not the crown of creation. The church is a parenthesis in God's plan of salvation. We are fortunate enough to be engrafted into the covenant that wasn't ours, but after God has filled the number of Gentiles he intends to bring in, he's going to return back and finish the book of Hosea. So that's why the book of Hosea is so important. Got all that? The word of the Lord that came unto Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea. This is the first time that God has ever talked to Hosea. And God's first message to Hosea is, the Lord said to Hosea, go marry a whore. Good start. Now, by the way, I don't think most preachers could get away with this today. God told me, marry a whore. It's just not likely to go over big. But no, really. No, God said, no. The beginning of the word of the Lord by Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go take thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredom, for the land has committed great whoredom in departing from the Lord. So God is going to make Hosea marry a whore and have children by this whore for the purpose of saying, by example, Israel, my wife, Israel, who I have betrothed, has become a whore to me because she's worshiping other gods. So he has likened the worship of other gods to committing whoredom, which is just repugnant to God. So he went back, and he took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bore him a son. So the Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I will avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, and will cause to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. And it shall come to pass at that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. So she conceived again, and she bare him a daughter. And God said unto him, call her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel. I will utterly take them away. Lo-Ruhamah. Ruhamah means mercy or merciful, or God has mercy. Lo means not, no mercy. Verse 7. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah. See the separation? See the distinction? The northern tribes, Israel, no mercy. The southern tribes, Judah, yes, still mercy. I will have mercy on the house of Judah, and I will save them by the Lord their God, and will not save them by bow, nor by sword, nor by battle, nor by horses, nor by horsemen. In other words, I will save them by my own power. They're not going to do it by their armies. It won't be by their might. It won't be by their hand. It will be the protective hand of God over Judah that will preserve them. Because Judah, as I said, had to be preserved. They had to remain intact until the Messiah came. Now, when she had weaned Lo Ruhamah, she conceived and she bore him a son. Then said God, call his name Lo Amai, for ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. Lo Amai means exactly that. Amai, my people. Lo Amai, not my people. So he's had three kids so far. The first kid was called Jezreel to remind them of why God was judging them. The second one was Lo Ruhamai, no mercy. The third child's born, and he says, call him not my people. This is all typical of how he was going to treat Israel forthcoming.
This translation translates Jezreel as God scatters.
God scatters. Mm-hmm. Yeah, God's going to scatter you. You're not my people, and I have no mercy. Those are the three kids. Now, by the way, that all happened. God, in fact, brought Assyria down on them. God, in fact, took them into the Assyrian captivity. God, in fact, scattered them across Europe. He absolutely did it. Now, during the time, now you got to remember this, during the time of their occupation in Assyria, they were already worshiping foreign gods. They had stopped keeping anything that looked Jewish. They weren't keeping Jewish Sabbaths or Jewish days. They weren't keeping Jewish feasts. They weren't eating kosher foods. They weren't doing anything that looked Jewish. And then by the time they left Assyria, the ones that did come back to their own land found that the land was occupied by Assyrian rebels and slaves and everybody who'd gone in there. They intermarried with them because they had already adopted the religions of Assyria. So it was easy for them to intermarry with the Assyrians that lived there. And those people became Samaritans because they lived in the area of Samaria, but they were the half-breeds, the cross-breeds, the Samaritans. That's why the southern tribe, the Jews, so hated the Samaritans because they weren't pure anymore. The Jews considered themselves pure, but the Samaritans were half-breeds, intermarried Israelites, which gives you some idea why the Good Samaritan story is so interesting. By the time that happened, they had lost all semblance of being Jewish. So when you go looking for the lost tribes, you're not looking for people wearing yarmulkes and having long braids and keeping Jewish holidays. And you're looking for people who are utterly and completely worldly, completely not Jewish in any sense. The people who say when Israel was restored in 1948 and all those people returned there, that's the regathering that we've heard about. That's the return of Israel. No, it's not. If they've come back keeping the Jewish religion, that's the return of Judah. Those are the people, the southern tribe, that have always kept the Jewish religion. But the Israelites, the northern tribe, from the minute they went under Jeroboam the king, they started worshiping other gods, and they lost their whole Jewish history. They don't know who they are anymore. They're not trying to be Jewish. They don't know that they're Ephraim. They don't know that they're Dan. They have no idea that they're Reuben. They have no idea. They've lost all of their enculturalization that would let them know who they were historically. Why? Because God had no mercy, scattered them, and you're not my people. So they have no sense that they're the people of God. They have no sense that they're Israel. So whoever they are, and they're out there, I mean, you know, God didn't take them to the middle of a desert somewhere and wipe them out. They've continued to procreate. They've continued to have children and intermarry and have children and intermarry. But you find out in the Old Testament that if one of the two parents is an Israelite, God continues to keep them as part of Israel in his mind and in his thought. God knows. God's keeping count. God knows where his people are. They don't know who they are because they're not his people. But he knows. So the very fact that he has not restored them yet and brought them back yet doesn't mean anything. Exactly what God said would happen here by Hosea has in fact happened. They've been scattered. They've lost their heritage. They've lost their peoplehood. They don't know God. God isn't their God anymore. They're not Israelites. They're scattered people. God's had no mercy on them. But now the rest of the story. Yet, verse 10, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea. They're going to continue to grow and procreate and have kids and become this innumerable group of people. They won't know who they are, but God will know, and they'll continue to become everything he promised to Abraham, that they would become this innumerable, huge group of people, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there it shall be said unto them, you are the sons of the living God. There's a revelation coming for them. It hasn't happened yet. But wherever they are, where they're being called not my people, where is that place? What's the whole world where they've been scattered to? They've been scattered away from their land, out of Samaria, out to the rest of the world, and called not my people. But there's an absolute promise here that one day, in the place where they were called not my people, God said, I'll return to you, and you'll be called the sons of the living God. It's an absolute promise. It has to happen. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head or one king, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. So there is a day coming when not just Judah, which right now, ever since 1948, happens to be gathered over there in the land of Israel, but Judah and Israel, the scattered Israel, has to regather back to that land. That hasn't happened. Then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say ye unto your brethren, Ami, and say to your sisters, Ruhamah. So when they've been regathered, they're to turn to each other and say, God is merciful, and you are the children of God. You are God's people. See, he took the lo away on both of those. Lo Ami, lo Ruhamah, no more. When I regather you, you will call each other Ami and Ruhamah. You will say, God has restored us. We are God's people. The mercy is back. That has to happen. Hasn't happened yet. Hosea got the first half exactly right. I believe he's equally going to be right about the second half. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife. Neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight, and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked, and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. For their mother has played the harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully, for she said, I will go after my lovers, that give me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. That doesn't mean much to us anymore, but in Assyria, one of the things that they had going, and part of the Assyrian gods that they worshipped, which were called the Baals, especially to the sun god, the chief Baal, they had what were basically whores that lived in the temple. And they lived off their whoredoms. And so if a man would come in, rather than give you money, he would promise to bring you oil or barley or wheat or whatever it is you needed to keep your household going. So it was a barter system, sex for stuff. And that's what God was referring to here. He said that's what Israel's become like now. As they've gone and worshipped all these other gods, they've worshipped these other gods so that they can get along, so that they can buy more stuff, so they can get more barley and wheat. And yes, they seem to be very wealthy, and yes, they seem to be doing very well by the world's standards. But it's because they've bought the stuff of the world with their whoredoms. So he likened them to the whores that worshipped in the temples of the Baals. Pretty rough language. I mean, God's really castigating them for worshiping these other gods and chasing after other gods. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns and make a wall, and she shall not find her paths. Now, this is wonderful. I'm sorry, I love this story. Here's what he's told Hosea. Go marry yourself a whore. He marries the whore. He has a son with her. Now, from this verse where it says, your children are children of whoredoms, there's the implication that those two other kids, Lo Ami and Lo Ruhamah, there's the implication then that those weren't even Hosea's kids, that she had continued practicing her whoredoms and had had these kids by other men as well. So what's Hosea going to do? I mean, he really ought to kill the wench. But instead, if he were to do that, she being the type of Israel, if he were to do that, then that would be God casting off Israel. And so instead, God is going to express an unbelievable love here and says, here's the first thing I'm going to do. I'm going to protect her from herself, and I'm going to put up a wall of thorns, and I'm going to build a hedge around her that she can't get through, and I'm going to cut off the pathways that would let her get to her illicit lovers. The first thing I'm going to do is protect her from her own whoredom. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy ways with thorns. I will make a wall that she shall not find her paths. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but she shall not find them. And she shall say, then I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. So where's Israel heading? Back to their first husband. Who's that? God. Yeah. The one who betrothed them in the first place. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for the Baal. What they didn't realize is they thought it was their own strength that was making them wealthy, and that it was their whoredoms and their sexual favors that were getting them all this stuff. And he says, what they didn't realize is that I provided them all this. I kept them alive. I'm the one that provided them with all this. And then what did they do with it? Did they worship me with it? No, they went and they gave it to the Baals. They gave it to the fake gods. They took it to their lovers. But I'm the one that provided it. Therefore, verse 9, will I return? Look what God's going to do. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof. I will recover my wool and my flax, given to cover her nakedness. And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of my hand. In other words, I'm going to make her pay. I'm going to go, I'm going to catch her, I'm going to make her starve, I'm going to take away all that stuff she got by her whoredoms, and I'm going to make her pay. And that's exactly what he did to Israel. You're going to pay. You're going to pay for what you've done. And so he scattered Israel, took away their wealth, caused them to be scattered. But now look, I will also cause all her happiness, her mirth, to cease. Her feast days, they're not going to keep feast days anymore. Her new moons, they're not going to keep the Jewish new moons and Sabbaths. Or her Sabbaths, all her solemn feasts, God's going to wipe them out of Israel. Israel's not going to do that anymore. I will destroy her vines and her fig trees, whereof she has said, these are my rewards that my lovers have given me, and I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall eat them. And I will visit upon her the days of Balaam. In other words, those days that they worship the Baals, he's going to take those days and visit them on them again, make them pay for it. Wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and she went after her lovers, and she forgot me, says the Lord. Then, what's he going to do? Is he going to cast her off once and for all and forget her? No, therefore, behold, I will allure her. I'll draw her back to me. Once she's desperate, once I've taken away all the money and the gold and the earrings and the fine clothes, after I've taken away all the stuff that she's out there celebrating and giving to the Baals, she doesn't realize I'm the one that gave it to her. So once I take it all away from her, she'll be destitute. And once she's destitute, rather than squash her, I'll love her and bring her back to myself. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, and I'll bring her out into the wilderness, and I will speak comfortably to her. And I will give her vineyards from thence, and the valley of Achor for a door of hope, and she will sing there, as in the days of her youth, and in the days when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And it shall be at that day, says the Lord, that she shall call me Ishi, which basically means friend. Do you have an interpretation? My husband. Yeah, it means my compatriot, the one that walks alongside me. Husband's a perfect word for it. You shall no more call me Baali or Baalai, which is a plural of Baal. You will no longer worship gods that are Baals. You'll finally worship me for what I am, that I'm your husband. I'm the one that betrothed you. I'm your friend. I'm the one who cares about you. For I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground, and I will break the bow of the sword and the battle out of the earth, and I will make them to lay down safely. Now, has that happened? That's a promise from God that he is going to return Israel, and when he returns Israel, that he will make a covenant not just with Israel, but with the beasts of the field, with the birds that fly in the sky, with all the creeping things of the ground, and then he's going to break the bow and the sword, and he's going to take all the battles out of the earth, and he's going to make Israel lay down safely. Israel's never laid down safely. To this day, Israel can't lay down safe. There's still bombs going off every time they turn around. People throwing rocks at them and blowing up their kids. Israel's yet to lay down safely. By the way, keep your finger right there. Turn backwards to Isaiah. Before Daniel, before Ezekiel, go to Isaiah. Before Jeremiah. Isaiah 11. Keep your finger in Hosea there. Isaiah 11, starting at verse 1. Isaiah was a contemporary of Hosea. They lived around the same time. They had very similar prophecies. They talked about the same things, the scattering and the destruction of Israel, and the restoration. They were very much contemporaries in Israel. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Who was Jesse? You know who that was? David's father. So it's a branch coming out of the house of David. It's a prediction of Christ coming. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, and the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of fear of the Lord, and shall make him of quick understanding in the fear of the Lord, and he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither reprove after the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. Does that sound familiar, by the way? When Jesus did show up, what did he say about the meek? He said the meek would inherit the earth. Absolutely, yeah. That's why Jesus stood up and said that. He was fulfilling the prophecies of Isaiah. And he shall smite the earth with a rod out of his mouth, and the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Does that sound like the book of Revelation? Any of that sound familiar to you? That there will be a two-edged sword come out of his mouth, with which he will slay the wicked, and he will rule the earth with a rod of iron. Isaiah said all that was coming. So now clearly we've leapt forward in time, haven't we? By the time he's got the two-edged sword and the rod of iron, we're now talking about his second coming, right? So Isaiah just leapt from the first coming to the second coming, and what will it be like when he returns? Righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, faithfulness the girdle of his reins, and the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion and the fatling all together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear will feed together, their young ones will lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like an ox. And a sucking child shall play on the hole of an asp or a poisonous snake, and the weaned child shall put his hand in a cockatrice den, which is scorpions. And they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Does that sound familiar? It sounds very much like, in that day I will make a covenant with them, and with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of the heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground. And I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and they will lie down safely. It's the same promise. When God restores Israel, he's going to restore the earth. Paul, remember in the book of Romans, said that the whole creation groans for the redemption. Not just the people, but the earth itself groans for the day of redemption when peace will finally be on the earth. And that peace won't just be men don't fight anymore, but animals don't fight anymore. Animals that would otherwise eat each other will lay down together and chew grass. That hasn't happened yet, but it's gonna. In that day, I'm still in Isaiah 11, by the way. And in that day, there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for a sign, an ensign for the people. And to it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. That's the rest of the promise that Hosea saw, that they would have the rest. There'd be no more battle. It shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord, that the Lord shall set his hand again a second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathros, and from Cush, and from Elam, and from Shinar, and from Hamath, and from the islands of the sea, and he will set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And the envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim will not envy Judah, and Judah shall not envy Ephraim, but they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together, and they shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab. Who's in Edom and Moab? We already know who's waiting there. Who's there? The remnant that went through the tribulation from Daniel. He will lay his hands on Edom and Moab and all the children of Ammon. There they are, Edom, Moab, and Ammon shall all obey them, and the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea. With a mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and he shall smite it with seven streams and make men go over dry shod. There will be a highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was in Israel when they came up out of the land of Egypt. What does all that say? All that says there's a time coming when the Lord is going to restore the whole creation. The animals will be at rest. Little children are going to lead lions around, which, by the way, my kids can't wait for. And during that time, there's going to be a sign, a signal in Jerusalem. It's going to be Christ himself. And all of the nations of the Gentiles are going to come to him as he rules with a rod of iron. And during that time, he will regather Ephraim and Judah. When he regathers Ephraim and Judah, there'll be no more jealousy, no more fighting between them, which is what started all this. That whole Jezreel thing, there will be no more jealousy, no more fight between them. He's going to gather them all together. They're going to live as one nation. David, their king's going to be raised up again. And the Prince of Peace will sit on his throne for 1,000 years. Where do I get this whole...
The Amels hate that verse, the whole book, chapter out of that.
Yeah, well, you know, they don't have much of a theology either, do they? How do you ignore all this? It's a consistent theology all the way through this book.
There's way too much detail there to be spiritualized either.
Absolutely. Way too much detail to be spiritualized.
Absolutely. Never this detail.
And he says, I will gather them a second time to this land. He did it once. He told us when it was. He brought them out of Egypt, and he gathered them to this land. And then he said, now I'm going to do that a second time. And how's he going to do it? He's going to dry up the river. He's going to take the Egyptian Sea, just like he did the Red Sea. He's going to dry it up into seven streams and make a highway straight into his city so that he can regather them from all the corners of the earth. From the isles of the sea, those people out there, from all the four corners, from Egypt, from Cush, that's South Africa, from every corner, he's going to bring his people back from where he scattered them and reestablish them there in Jerusalem. It's so consistent. The whole picture is there. I'm back in Hosea. I think we left off at 18, which is in that day I'll make a covenant with them and the beasts of the field. That's where how we ended up in Isaiah, because we had to see the covenant made with the beasts of the field. Verse 19, and I will betroth unto me, I will remarry Israel unto me forever. Did you get that? So, has their sin, has their scattering, has all that stopped God in any way from completing what he intends to do? No, absolutely not. Because in that day, what day? When he makes a covenant with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the snakes and the cockatrice dens on the ground. That hasn't happened yet. You send your kids out and have them stick their hand in a nest of scorpions, they're going to get stung. As long as that happens, God isn't doing this yet. Is that too obvious? But in the day that he does all that, which hasn't happened yet, he is going to remarry Israel to himself forever. And I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercy. Not because they earned it, not because they deserve it. All the people who say God has cast off Israel forever, their justification is, well, Israel sinned. Big deal, Christie sinned, right? Like a bunch of times, more than likely. I'm guessing that part. So did God cast her off for her sins? No. He saved her by mercy, judgment, righteousness, grace. So how's he going to save Israel? Judgment, mercy, righteousness, grace. Same deal, same God, same people. He loves his people because he loves his people. And if they sin, yes, they're going to end up paying for it. But will he cast them off forever? No, absolutely not. Once they're his, that's that. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and you will know the Lord. Okay, so why will they know the Lord? Because God's faithful. Not because they're smart. But they have a covenant that God made with himself, that God is faithful to, where he says, you will know me because I am faithful. You get all that? Why does Jen know the Lord? It's because God is faithful. Not because Jen was that clever or smart or figured it out or worked it out or was that good or that righteous or God just couldn't get along without her. But because God was faithful to himself for that purpose, he saved his people whom he foreknew, whom he loved in advance. And then she came along and she acted like Jen. And the flesh went nuts and she went nuts and God should have cast her off. But he didn't because God's faithful. You get that? The same faithful God said here, I will marry you unto me in faithfulness, and you will know the Lord. Why? Because God's faithful. It's that same old God. It's that same old salvation plan. It's just that he's doing it there with a nation. He did it here with Jen. Verse 21, it shall come to pass in that day that I will hear, said the Lord, I will hear from the heavens. And they shall hear the earth. And the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil. And they shall hear Jezreel. And I will sow her unto me in the earth. And I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to them that were not my people, you are my people. And they shall say, and you are my God. That's a promise. Hasn't happened yet. He said, I'm going to restore to them everything I took from them. I'm going to restore all the land. I'm going to restore the oil. I'm going to restore the wine. I'm going to restore the gladness. I'm going to make them rich. I'm going to make them happy. I'm going to give them everything. And in that day, when I have done all that, I will say to them, you're my people. And they'll say, yep, and you're our God. Then said the Lord unto me, chapter 3, then said the Lord unto me, go yet, love a woman, beloved of her friend, yet an adulteress, according to the love of the Lord toward the children of Israel, who look to other gods, and they love their flagons of wine. Drunken old Israel chasing after other gods. He told Hosea, now go and love an adulteress the same way I've loved Israel. So I bought her to me, for 15 pieces of silver, and for a homer of barley and a half homer of barley. And I said unto her, you shall abide for me many days. Thou shalt not play the harlot. Thou shalt not be for another man. So will I also be for thee. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king, and without a prince, and without a sacrifice, and without an image, and without an ephod, and without the teraphim. Two of the things that the high priest was given as part of his mantle and his crown and his whole outfit. He was given two things called the ephod and the teraphim. And he used those to find out the mind of the Lord. And they've kind of been lost to antiquity. They're talked about in the book of Exodus. And they're described, but we don't really know what they were. We don't know if they were like a dice that you threw to find out yes or no from God. Nobody really knows how they worked or what they were. But God said very specifically that they would be used so that the priest could discover the mind of the Lord. So he said, the children of Israel would abide many days without a king, so they're not going to be a nation or a kingdom. They don't have a king. They don't have a prince. There's nobody ruling over them. They don't have a sacrifice, which means that there's no way for them to come to grips with God and have the sacrificial system. They wouldn't have an image. They would have nothing. They wouldn't have the Ark of the Covenant with the angel images on top of it. They wouldn't have anything that they could sacrifice with or to. They wouldn't have an ephod, and they wouldn't have a teraphim, so they would never know the mind of the Lord. Afterward, verse 5, shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king, and shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the last days. So he goes to Hosea and says, okay, you've had a wife. You had a kid with her. Now she's out having kids by other men. Here's what you do. Go back and buy her back, and then take her to yourself and say, you are the type of Israel who will return to God. How do you get her back? He bought her back. He wooed her back. He loved her back. How's God going to get Israel back? Buy him back, woo him back, love him back. The rest of the book of Hosea goes off now on Hosea saying, here's what God's going to do to you. And he commits to them what all the punishments are going to be that they're going to undergo. But at the end of the book in chapter 12, he once again reestablishes that God is going to bring them back. Do you get the picture of Hosea? Now let me show you this verse once more. Chapter 2, verse 23. I will sow her unto me in the earth. I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. By the way, does that sound familiar? In Romans, we've been reading, I'll have mercy on whom I'll have mercy. And I will say to them that were not my people, you are my people. Okay, now go to Romans. I'm in Romans 9. Last week we spent a lot of time on the potter and the clay, and that the potter has power over the clay of one lump to make one vessel to honor and another to dishonor. What if God is willing to show his wrath and to make his power known, and he endured with much long-suffering the vessels of wrath fitted for destruction, that he might make known the riches of his glory on the vessels of mercy which he had afore prepared for glory, even us, whom he has called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. Verse 25, as he said also in Hosea. Now you'll get what this means. I will call them my people which were not my people, and call her beloved which was not beloved. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said unto them, you are not my people, there shall they be called the children of the living God. Who's Paul talking about? Israel. He has to be talking about Israel. Who else could he be talking about? That's who Hosea was talking about. Now, did Paul anywhere here take that verse from Hosea and say, and when he said that, he meant the church? No, Paul doesn't do that. Now, I'm also going to tell you what tricky theologians do. Tricky theologians who want to escape. Amillennial tricky theologians. Remember that band? That was a good band. The Amillennial Tricky Theologians. They, in order to avoid everything I just taught you, because it's so obvious, it's so plain, it's so clear, in order to avoid it, they go to verse 24, where it says, even us whom he has called not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles, as he said also in Hosea, I'll call them my people, which were not my people. They say, the Gentiles weren't God's people, never were God's people, Israel was. And so when he said, I'll call them my people that weren't my people, he's talking about the Gentiles. He's going to call the Gentiles his people who never were his people. And he's going to call them beloved who weren't beloved. And it'll come to pass that in the place where they weren't his people, they'll be his people. So all those Gentiles out in those Gentile nations that weren't his people became his people. That's the interpretation that Paul meant there. Wasn't that easy? Because he says right there, and the Gentiles. So that must be who he's referring to here. Can you see how tricky that is? The problem is, of course, with it, that Hosea was talking very specifically about Israel. And that when Paul brought it up here, he doesn't say, and now when I interpret this verse, I mean it to mean the Gentiles. This whole argument is about Israel. The beginning of chapter 9 was about Israel. Has God cast off his people whom he foreknew? Paul's argument is no, God forbid, God would not cast off his people whom he foreknew. Look at me, I'm a Jew, I'm an Israelite, I'm a Benjamite, God saved me, so clearly he hasn't cast off his people. And oh yeah, what did Hosea say? Hosea said, yeah, it doesn't look like they're my people right now. But in the place where they're called not my people, they're going to be called my people. And in the place where it says they're not beloved, they're going to be beloved. That's Paul's argument. He's still talking about Israel. So you can't take that verse out of context and try to apply it to the Gentiles. That's not biblically honest. It's not good scriptural exegesis. And by the way, the very next verse, I hate verse numbers because it gives you the sense that Paul has somehow changed subjects because there's a number there. But look at the beginning of verse 27. He has just said, in the place where it said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called the children of the living God. And Isaiah also cries concerning Israel. And then he tells you what Isaiah said about Israel. So if he said Isaiah also said about Israel, then he clearly meant that Hosea was talking about Israel. Is that obvious enough? Paul's context is Israel. He started chapter 9 with Israel. He's been talking about Israel. He went all the way through, Jacob have I loved, Esau have I hated, that God has the right to elect within Israel, that not all Israel is of Israel, and not every one of Abraham's kids are counted for the seed. The subject is still Israel. Then he goes on to talk about the potter and the clay, which takes you back to Jeremiah, so he's still talking about Israel. See the context? And by the way, Isaiah also says concerning Israel. So nowhere in there has Paul suddenly made some huge exegetical leap where he said, and oh yeah, in the middle of my big Israel argument, I want to mention that when Hosea said all that stuff about Israel, that the fulfillment of that is Gentiles somehow. If Paul had meant that, shouldn't he have mentioned it somewhere? Because he certainly didn't say it anywhere. So Isaiah also cried concerning Israel, and he said, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. He's continuing his argument that God has the right to elect, and that God has always kept a remnant within Israel. During the time of the tribulation, there will be a remnant of Israel. Where are they going? Moab, Ammon, Edom. They're going to be up in the wilderness, hiding in the mountains, doing exactly what Daniel said they should do, exactly what Jesus said they should do. He told the Israelites who asked him, when you see the idols set up in Jerusalem in the temple, then you know it's time to flee to the wilderness. And they already knew where to go. And it's the same place Isaiah said that the Gentiles would go get them and bring them back to their land. It's all fitting together now. See, eschatology actually is important, ain't it? It really does help you get a good overall view of the Bible. By the way, that's Isaiah 10, 22 to 23. If anybody wants to look it up, the place that he's quoting out of Isaiah is Isaiah 10, 22 and 23. Though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. God will elect a remnant, for he will finish the work, and he will cut it short in righteousness, because a short work will the Lord make upon the earth. That's Isaiah 23. It's also Isaiah 28, 22. And as Isaiah said before that, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we would have been as Sodom and would have been made like unto Gomorrah. That's Isaiah 1:9. In other words, he's saying, look, Israel deserved to be cut down. We're every bit as bad as Sodom and Gomorrah. And unless God was merciful to us, we would have been like Sodom and Gomorrah, but he was merciful to us. And he always kept the remnant, and he's always preserved Israel, and he's always known where they are, and he's keeping an eye on them because he's going to regather them and restore them. By the way, do you know what the word Sabaoth means there?
It says Almighty.
Almighty? Yeah, the real translation is armies of heaven. The one who rules over the armies of heaven. That's the one who's in control. That one is the one that's preserving Israel. So I don't care what kind of errant theology you make up. Your errant theology can't stop Lord God Sabaoth. He's ruling in heaven, and the armies of heaven are doing his will, and the whole earth reacts to whatever it is he wants to do. He's the potter, you're the clay. And if the clay wants to make up little clay theology that's different than the Lord God Sabaoth theology, that doesn't stop the Lord God. He's going to do what he's going to do. He's going to restore Israel. But first, before he does that, we're gone. We're going to watch him do all this.